TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports.
NFL is back.
All the time. A division of Bell Media. TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of in-depth analysis, insight, and opinion into Canada's game. And now, here's Drew, Richard, and Ezra.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us online at tsn1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my good friend, Ezra Ginsberg. Richard Pollock is away this week. He is currently shopping for art in Toronto, and I'm not making that up. So we're joined by our third this week. Michael Remus comes from behind the glass to join us here in studio. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. Gentlemen, good morning. How are you?
Well, good afternoon. It's noon. So
it's good afternoon, yes.
You know, a minute ago, it was the morning. But yeah, we're going to miss Richie, but we got Michael, who takes a back seat to nobody, usually running the R desk, and we have a lot to talk about. Game two. Game one was maybe a little bit disappointing for some people, but we still have a packed show. Gary Lawless is coming in. Well, not coming in. He's on the road, but he's going to come on later. So it's going to be a great show today, as usual.
Absolutely. The guests today coming up in about 30 minutes' time, our good friend. He's the Devils play-by-play man on WFAN Radio in New Jersey. That is Matt Lachlan. Matt's going to join us, as he has really throughout the postseason, as the Devils have made this incredible run. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Rick Ralph, you know him from the station. He's going to join us for a little bit of hockey talk. 1:30 this afternoon from the Windsor Star, Bob Duff is going to join us. Talk Nicholas Lidstrom's retirement. That happened earlier this week. Talk about the Red Wings as a whole. Coming up sometime in the last hour, probably around 2 o'clock, Gary Lawless is going to join us from New Jersey, where he's, of course, covering the Stanley Cup Finals for TSN 1290 and for the Winnipeg Free Press. And at 2:30 this afternoon from ESPNChicago.com, Jesse Rogers is going to join us to talk some Blackhawks. We'll probably touch on Patrick Kane and his... Well, let's just call it problems. Going to talk about some of the moves. They re-signed Johnny Oduya this week, so we'll talk to Jesse Rogers about that in the final hour of the program. In order to reach us here in studio, the best way to do it is on Twitter. Send us your tweets at Illegal Curve. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. Michael, we've yet to hear from you this morning. First of all, how is your finger, which was the victim of a tragic knife finger accident earlier this week?
It was pretty good. I spent a lot of time in the waiting room and got this really nice bandage holding up well. Bandage comes off tomorrow.
Very good. That's exciting. But so that's an artificial finger, I assume, now. Is that right?
Not quite. I have most of the top knuckle and the fingernail. It's still all there.
No, that's good to know. So you're not quite the bionic man. But anyways, good of you to join us in studio while you're playing injured this week.
I'm always happy to be here, you know, this morning.
Yes, this morning, this afternoon, whatever time it is.
Well, it's good because, Michael, you unfortunately... fortunately, you only have to use your mouth for the radio, so you're not going to have to use your fingers, and I'm sure that that's going to heal up, but, fortunately, you're going to be able to provide analysis and do what you do without the use of that index finger. It's the index finger, isn't it?
The index. They told me that I'm missing a chunk of skin, but fortunately, they told me at the doctor's office that skin grows back.
Oh, well, that's exciting. So good to know that you won't be permanently damaged or scarred. Well, emotionally, obviously, you already are, but
yeah, we'll be
physically,
nice. We'll be nice to Michael.
Physically, you'll be okay. Let's get started by talking. Obviously, we're going to spend the first about 45 minutes of the program talking about game one that happened a few nights ago,
yep,
and game two, which gets underway at 7 o'clock tonight here in Winnipeg, and then Matt Lachlan's going to join us to give some even more insight into the series. Game one happened Wednesday night. Then they took another 2 days off, which is, these hockey players like routine. And their routine has been totally thrown off. They played one game in the last, 10 days for most of these guys. It's just too long to go between games. So they're really itching now that the series is going to go every second night, at least for the next few games, to finally get back into more of a routine. But that game one really did take about 40 minutes or so until the players had felt their way through the first couple periods and had shaken off a little bit of the rust. And I don't think I'm, telling telling secrets outside of school when I say that the first two periods of game one were pretty dull.
The first, yeah, the game, you know, as a whole was pretty dull. And I, you know, I thought that it did get going in the second period. Obviously, Colin Fraser got the Kings on the board in the second period, and then Volchenkov got the goal that bounced off of Voyanov's face late in the second period. But the first period was a really, you know, a testing out each other kind of period. And, you know, it was sloppy. There was eight or nine total shots. You know, I actually thought that the Kings were the better team in the first period, but the Devils weren't creating much offense at all in the first period, and they didn't start really getting going until late in the second. And, you know, a lot of people were talking about the fact that this was the Kings' worst game, and, you know, that shows you that the Kings can even play a bad game and still win. They've yet to lose a game on the road. But, you know, if you were watching that game, and obviously we all were, in the third period, there were a couple of chances, and the Devils easily could have taken that lead. There was a chance for Mark Fain.
Well, Mark Fain,
he couldn't get, you know, couldn't tap in a rebound.
To his credit, though, I want to, sorry for interrupting here, Ezzy, yep. But to Mark Fain's credit, I mean, and you know how sick he must have felt, especially after they ended up losing the game. I mean, he had a wide open net. I mean, he's a defenseman, so you don't typically get to be right next to the net.
Right.
But he stood in front of the cameras after the game, and he answered every question. He didn't hide. He was right there. He manned up to the moment. And you got to feel, you know, the puck was there, and it bounced on him.
And I've been saying this, you know, the whole playoffs. Mark Fain is an underrated defenseman, and I actually really appreciated the fact that Pierre Maguire on NBC was talking about that. You know, Mark Fain is a defensive defenseman. He's very good positionally, and this is only his second full-time year with the Devils, but he's been really good. And, you know, he made the proper read and jumped into the play, and he was unable to finish it off. Voyanov came back and made a nice play and kind of disrupted him enough so that he couldn't get a chance. But then later on in that period, Zach Parise had a chance off of a rebound, off of a Fain shot, and obviously he did put it in with his hand.
Yeah, Emerson was very happy about that play. I mean, going back to the famous Jets-Blackhawks game where Emerson won the game in overtime by throwing the puck into the net.
But the Devils had chances. I mean, they didn't have a lot of chances, but they had some chances, and over time, even Ilya Kovalchuk was buzzing around. And to me, the one thing about that game that was a little bit uncharacteristic of the Devils is that Kovalchuk and Parise both like to shoot. And they seemed, for whatever reason, to be looking for a really nice, beautiful feed. And for those players, you know, that's not characteristic of them. They're the type of guys that will really shoot from everywhere, and they're usually, you know, top of the league in shots. So it was a sloppy game for both teams, but I don't really think that the New Jersey Devils were by any means outplayed, and they really had an opportunity in the third period in overtime to win that game. And obviously they're going to have to make some adjustments because they were pinching too much, and the goal that was scored, Marek Zidlicky did pinch, and Danius Zubras and Bryce Salvador both went to take Justin Williams, and credit Justin Williams. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times written by Lisa Dillman about how Justin Williams is a guy, you remember in 2006, he got the game-winning goal for the Carolina Hurricanes.
Sure.
He's a very good player. And on that line, everyone talks about Dustin Brown and Andre Kopitar. But on that goal, that was Drew Doughty making a smart pass up to Justin Williams. But then Justin Williams realizing that two guys were coming at him and Andre Kopitar was just waiting for that pass. So yeah,
it's amazing that you can leave Andre Kopitar wide open like the Devils did in that instance. But I promise you that'll be,
that won't happen again, Drew.
No, because they'll adjust to that.
Danius Zubras is not a very good skater. And in his position, you know, he had to make a decision. But you can trust me that Peter DeBoer is going to make sure that a situation like that doesn't happen again. When that line is on the ice, you have to know who's on the ice, and they didn't. And, you know, things happen really quickly. And in the playoffs, when every single mistake is magnified, and on that first goal, another thing, Andy Green coughed up the puck. But in the playoffs, you simply have to know who's on the ice. And as far as the game goes, that's all it takes. Two mistakes. Both LA goals were because of miscues.
Anything in that game lead you to believe that this isn't going to be a long series? You know, let's get that Remus in on that one first. I mean, anything that you saw in that game that says, you know, I'm going to recalibrate my predictions and say LA is going to win this in four or five? Or was it so evenly matched really throughout the contest that, yeah, it really just affirmed for you that this is going to be a 6-7 game series?
I think at this point in the series, you know, as the first game went into overtime, one goal game, you know, the teams maybe weren't playing at their best for the first 40 minutes, so it's really tough to, you know, reevaluate. I think, yeah, it probably is going to go maybe between 5 and 7 games.
To me, five would still be it would be quick. I don't expect that to. I still don't expect it to be a five-game series. Anytime you're dealing with a one-goal overtime game, you're talking about one bounce, one puck going one way versus another. That keeps the games very close and keeps them, keeps the series very close as a result.
And LA was completely dominant in the first round against Vancouver, completely dominant against the St. Louis Blues, and pretty dominant against the Coyotes. And I still like the Kings in this series, and I don't think they're, and I said this when we were previewing the Stanley Cup Finals last week, the Kings aren't going to be able to dominate the New Jersey Devils. Both teams are very aggressive, and if you look at all the scoring chances in the game, it's because they like to activate their D, and they like to get in on the forecheck, and the Devils are going to have to deal with that. And to be honest with you, if the Devils aren't able to establish their forecheck, because the Kings are the type of team, they have some mobile guys. Drew Doughty is playing unreal, and he's a very mobile defenseman. But guys like Willie Mitchell and Matt Green and Rob Scuderi, those are old-school defensemen, veteran guys. They get the puck, they get it out, because the Kings have very fast forwards. They get it out quickly. So the Devils are going to have to maybe try to dump it into soft spots, get their forecheck going, and try to take a little bit more advantage of the size that they've had.
Their forecheck, sorry for jumping in on you there, but you look at their forecheck, how it was performing against the Rangers, especially towards the end of that series, but really throughout that series. And then you look at their forecheck as it was performing against the Kings in Game 1, and it wasn't the same forecheck. And I suspect that, I'm not sure if that was a result of some strategy that they had implemented, or simply a result of getting their legs back under them after being off for so long. But I think tonight with Game 2, you're going to see them. You'll see the aggressive forechecking Devils that we had seen throughout the playoffs right up until Game 1.
The one thing I really like about the Kings' defense is they're very solid and steady. You think of guys like Scuderi, Mitchell, and Matt Green. They're all guys who have, either won a Stanley Cup or played in a Stanley Cup final. You combine that with Doughty, who was probably Canada's best player in the Olympics and is, playing at that level now.
And has found that level again, because throughout the regular season, he was not that Drew Doughty.
And Remus, that's a good point. They do have veterans that have been there, and as far as Drew Doughty goes, I mean, he might as well be a veteran. The guy's 21, 22 years old. He plays like a veteran.
Well, anytime you play for Canada for the gold medal, you've been in the key situations.
Yep.
There's not much more. I know that people talk about cup experience and cup finals experience. Playing for gold on home ice in Vancouver is the equivalent of playing for Game 7 in the Stanley Cup final, if not even amped up a little bit higher.
And to Reem's point, too, the New Jersey Devils were able to take advantage of a tired New York Rangers defense, and guys like Michael Delzato and Strahlman and even McDonough were coughing the puck up in that series. And that was a huge part of the Devils' success. They're not going to be able to do that against the Los Angeles Kings because, in my opinion, it is a more rounded veteran defense, and they're simply a well-rested team that isn't going to make those same mistakes. The Devils are going to have to get a little bit more aggressive, and they're definitely going to have to pepper quick with more shots. They had chances, but it's simply not enough when you've got a goalie playing at that high level. So, the Devils are, and they know this. Peter DeBoer is definitely thinking about this heading into Game 2 tonight, and they're going to have to get more aggressive, and they're going to have to get more physical. And they've got guys like David Clarkson, Zubras, even Parise and Zajac are guys that are aggressive and get in the corners, go get into the dirty areas. So they've really got to, put more pressure on LA, their defense. And I mean, it's pretty obvious. Anybody who watches the game, you have four or five shots a period. That's not going to cut it at this time of the year.
Exactly right. Let's leave it there. When we come back, much more about Game 2. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Coming up next segment, Devils play-by-play man Matt Lachlan. You can reach us in studio on Twitter at Illegal Curve. The website is www.illegalcurve.com. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Michael Remus, who's filling in for the vacationing Richard Pollock. We'll talk about some of Richard's other vacation festivities throughout the course of the show, because really the sound you hear in the distance is the bus coming that we're just going to drive right over Richard.
You might even want to call it the shiny bus.
It might have been a shiny bus, exactly. And we'll get to that throughout the program. Just because that's what you come to expect from the illegal. Anytime somebody's away on this show, they have to expect they're going to hear a little bit about the gears.
We throw them under the illegal curve bus.
Exactly,
we have an illegal curve bus, and it's there for people to be on the show to be thrown under.
Exactly right. No lineup changes for either team coming into Game 2 tonight.
Nope.
That's what we heard from after the morning skates earlier today from New Jersey. Are you surprised that the Devils don't turn to Henrik Talander, who's healthy now? He hasn't played a game in the playoffs yet. He's been out since just before the end of the regular season, if I'm not mistaken.
Since January. He's had injury problems for the last 2 years, actually.
Right. Are you surprised that the Devils don't turn to him at all today?
I am a little bit surprised, and Rich Shear of the Newark Star-Ledger wrote about this, how Henrik Talander is ready to go. And the problem right now is that there are a few guys that were playing earlier in the playoffs that aren't playing for the Devils, Peter Sikora and Adam Larson. Now, Adam Larson started off in the lineup, and then they took him out and they brought him back in.
He played some games in the first round against Florida, but really since then he's only seen a game, I think, of action. Didn't he play?
And then
a game
they brought him in against Philly, and then they took him back out. But Peter DeBoer likes what Peter Harold can bring, and Peter Harold has kept him out of the lineup. And then what happened was Jacob Josephson came back, and then Jakob Josefsson.
Yeah.
I forgot you spent some time in Sweden, Drew.
I read the NHL pronunciation guide. Either way. Yeah.
But Peter Sikora has come out of the lineup, and it's funny. Talander is a veteran defenseman, and he's been there too with Buffalo, and he's solid. And I wouldn't mind bringing him in. The only problem is I don't think it's clear who you would take out. It would have to be Peter Hill, because as far as I'm concerned, one of the best defensemen in that game, one, was Harold. I thought he was good. I thought Fain was good. It was actually Zidlicky and Green who had trouble with the top line of L.A. But as far as I'm concerned, the one guy that they might want to consider bringing back for some offense is Peter Sikora. Now Josefsson, he's good. I mean, he's going to see limited ice time on the third line, and he's the type of guy that can get in there. And I actually could see him being a factor in Game 2, knowing that they're going to need a little bit of a spark. And I think DeBoer is going to want to play four lines more so maybe than they did in Game 1. But it's a tough call with getting Talander back in the lineup. You're in Game 2 now of the Stanley Cup Finals, and you're putting in a guy who hasn't played since January. Sure, it could be a spark, but I think that right now they're not too sure. And all indications are he's not going to play because he didn't take the warm-up.
No, he skated with the Black Aces today, so he's not going to play. But,
and the Black Aces, for everyone who doesn't know,
is the
guys who aren't going to play in the starting lineup.
How much do you value staying with the guys that have got you this far versus upgrading your team when a guy has really, he's been ready. They say he's been ready to play for a couple weeks now. But they've been able to skate him. He's been able to get his legs back under him. So, how do you balance those two out between, rewarding the guys who got you this far versus upgrading potentially where you think it's an upgrade, if you think it's an upgrade, and putting yourself over the top to become a cup winner?
I think Henrik Talander is a good player, but I don't know if he's that much of an upgrade as what we have. And if you're the coach, Peter DeBoer, I think it's important to show confidence in the players that have got you there so far. Because
absolutely.
I think once you waver from that, it kind of could cause some, unrest or guys maybe changing their style of play to, play a bit different. But I think, you got to go. It's Game 2. Game 1 maybe was a bit of a wash. You got to put that behind you, go forward to Game 2. And if Game 2, you get the same result, maybe then it's time for a switch.
Right, Raymond. And you've got, right now, it's an interesting situation because, as we've talked about before, and all four lines for the LA Kings are playing well.
All four lines for the Devils are playing well also.
Absolutely. And you've got matchups and you have a guy like Marek Zidlicky who did get caught a couple times.
Marek Zidlicky is not known for his defensive prowess. So I do think that the Devils got caught a little bit, especially in overtime where it's the long change, in having Zidlicky on the ice in the first place against, Kopitar and Williams and Brown. That's not the matchup the Devils would probably want. Zidlicky they got from Minnesota for his power play skills and his offensive skills, more so than his defensive capabilities.
Zidlicky has really helped the Devils out because they don't have a lot of speed on the back end. And a guy like Zidlicky, he is good on the power play. And him and Kovalchuk have really actually done a nice job. They haven't gotten the results, but if you watch the Devils, they do put a lot of pressure on the other team, and they have guys that can – they have to pull the trigger. Kovalchuk's got to start shooting more. And over time, they all look to Kovalchuk. He's got the great shot. They're always going to look to Kovalchuk. He's got to shoot more. But Zidlicky has really helped them in the transition game, getting out of their own zone. But as far as bringing a guy like Talander in, it's a tough call because you're trying to give your team a boost by bringing in a veteran guy who's going to help you out, whether or not they match him up against the Richards, Carter, Penner line, or they try to maybe put him with Salvador and maybe create a defensive duo to go up against Brown, Doughty, and Williams.
As close to a shutdown pair as the Devils can get, because they don't have your traditional shutdown pair.
Talander's a shutdown defenseman.
Well, I mean, he's more suited to play a defensive role and to really match up against the guy.
Absolutely.
Than a guy like Marek Zidlicky.
He's not overly physical, but he's a very good skater. And you know, he was obviously brought in with Volchenkov. And Volchenkov is another guy who I think has played pretty well. But it's a tough call, and Remus made a good point about that. You're disrupting the chemistry, and then you're not showing confidence in your current lineup. And as far as I'm concerned, maybe if after tonight's game they're still having those problems, then Talander will be brought in, because we know he's not playing game two tonight.
Right. You look at the defensive time on ice for the Devils after game one. I mean, Marek Zidlicky led the team in time on ice at 23 minutes and 13 seconds. So they're, pardon me, I'm not even reading it properly. 24 minutes and 47 seconds is what Zidlicky played. Didn't play any shorthanded time, because that's not his strong suit, but he almost played 25 minutes in the game. Salvador played 24 minutes.
Yep.
Mark Fain played 21 minutes. Peter Harold played 21 minutes. Andy Green played almost 23 minutes. And Volchenkov rounded out the defenseman at only 18 minutes and 47 seconds.
Yep.
To me, that seems a little odd that Volchenkov played the least amount of minutes on the Devils team defense as a whole.
Well, and I mean, a guy like Volchenkov won't play on the power play, so Zidlicky's going to get – they had a couple power plays.
Yeah, Zidlicky had a minute 34 of power play time.
Yeah, so they only had a couple power plays, and he's going to get time on the ice for that, and that's a little explanation for that. But, I mean, Volchenkov is usually going to be third or fourth on the team in ice time. It's usually going to be led by Salvador. And then, obviously, Fain's numbers have gone up. Fain is used to be a third-pairing defense, but now they're actually moving him up. Peter Harrell didn't play that much. But, you know,
Peter Harrell played 21 minutes. He played 21 minutes.
Well, relatively speaking, he doesn't play that much.
It seems like they're riding everyone pretty evenly.
That's it. As opposed to what you saw from the Rangers is, you know, where they're only playing four or five defensemen throughout the course of the game. The Devils are playing all six of their defensemen, you know, upwards of 20 minutes, perhaps keeping them fresh throughout the series.
I'm sure if you look back at Peter Harold's numbers, by the way, it wouldn't be that high. But anyways, maybe that one game. If you look back, Drew, he usually doesn't play that much.
Well, then why did he play that much in game one?
Well, he played that much. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the question is, but he usually doesn't play that much, is what I'm saying.
Which is possible, but it seems like an odd time to jump a guy to playing 21 minutes a game if he hasn't been playing that much.
Andy Green didn't have a very good game, and that could have been one of the reasons why DeBoer wanted to play him more. But to be honest with you, the problem in that game was really not one single defenseman and the way they were playing. It was maybe two costly turnovers. I mean, Andy Green, he was pressured by Jordan Nolan on the forecheck, coughed up the puck. There's the first goal. And in overtime, you have a miscue where Danius Zubras doesn't see Andrei Kopitar coming and goes to get Justin Williams. So, I mean, really, aside from those two miscues, I really don't think that the Devils played that poorly in game one. Do you want to bring in Henrik Talander, because of a couple of guys that are making mistakes? I don't think that's why you'd want to bring him in. I think you'd want to bring him in if one guy really can't handle the physicality of the size of the top two lines. And really, that, I don't think, was the main issue.
Before we go to break, because we have Matt Lachlan coming up right after the commercials, Peter Harold played 21 minutes last game. And you're absolutely right, Ezzy, because the previous game, game six against the Rangers, he played 14 minutes. Yeah. Then he played 14 and a half minutes, 15 minutes, 16:40, 14:09. So he played about 5-6 minutes more in game one than he had played in almost any other game in the playoffs.
And that shows you that Peter DeBoer has confidence in him and probably doesn't want to take him out of the lineup at this point. I mean,
Well, sure, he played. If he had the, he obviously had a significant amount of confidence in him to play him that much in game one.
Absolutely, and I really think that the Devils, really, their matchups were fine. I think that first game was played so tightly and there were so few scoring chances. The Devils have to just smarten up. And I mean, you look at their defense, and it's been called the no-name defense, but really, they're pretty good positionally, and they play well as a unit. Really, you have to limit turnovers. If there's one team left that you don't want to make those turnovers, ask Vancouver, ask St. Louis. It's the Kings, right, with Brown and all these dangerous guys.
They have a lot of different ways that they can hurt you. Let's go to break. When we come back, Matt Lachlan, Devils play-by-play man, is set to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Let's go out to New Jersey, where we are joined by our good friend and frequent guest on this program, Matt Lachlan. Matt, good afternoon. How are you? Matt, are you there?
I am.
There you go. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing well, thank you. What's going on, fellas?
Not too much, not too much. Must be an exciting couple days in New York. First of all, you got Johan Santana's no-hitter last night, finally, for the Mets, and the big game two tonight.
Yeah, it's been a terrific start to the weekend. The Devils will try to hold up their end of the bargain tonight. But, yeah, this area is abuzz with both hockey talk and baseball talk. 50 years is a long time to wait for your first no-hitter.
Absolutely. It's amazing it took that long. But anyways, that's for another show at another date and time. Matt, you know, we were talking about game one prior to you coming on, but looking back at it, is it safe to say that the first 40 minutes of the game was sort of a feeling out period for the two teams and that the series really started going in the third period?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate statement. The teams this morning both indicated that the series is now engaged, and there was a sense of nervousness getting to know each other. You know, they don't play each other all that long. You shouldn't all that often. You really shouldn't need anything more than the Stanley Cup final to get the juices flowing. And it's not to say that the teams played in a flatlining type way, but I think there were some nerves certainly there, and I think we'll see a much better game tonight.
Matt, the Devils only managed 18 shots on Jonathan Quick in Game 1, and that included overtime. Is it pretty obvious that Pete DeBoer and the Devils coaching staff are going to tell their players to direct more shots on Quick for Game 2?
Yeah, they have to. I mean, not only the shots that he made saves on, but the total number of shots, both those blocked by the Kings and missed by the Devils, really the number tilted in LA's favor in that area. So the Devils only had 7 shots on goal in the third period, and that was the most they had in any one period, even including the overtime, as truncated as it was. So there's no doubt that they've got to get more pressure. Ilya Kovalchuk, while not coming out and saying that he's going to have 6 shots on goal or anything like that, but he had just one, and he vowed to be better tonight. He knows he's got to deliver some more goals toward Jonathan Quick. The top ones that he faced, he basically got. The only one that got past him was a deflected goal. So the Devils have to pressure him a lot more.
It looks like we won't have any lineup changes for Game 2, but Henrik Tillander is now healthy for the Devils. Do you expect to see him at all in this series?
Pete DeBoer did indicate today that there would be a chance. Now, whether or not he was indicating that was a definite scenario or a possibility, I'm not sure. Was he just hedging his bet there? No one really knows. We know that Hank will travel with the team tomorrow. He was not made available to the media today. He will travel with the team to L.A. tomorrow. And I think that Pete will make the decision based on what happens tonight. And perhaps if there's success, if the Devils come away with a victory, he may stick with the same hand going into Monday's game. I think he likes having the option, though, of a veteran guy, though he's not been in the lineup since January because of the blood clot in his leg. But I think he feels that the experience, the size, the ability to skate is certainly something that the Devils could use. It's not that they were overwhelmed by any stretch of the imagination by the Kings, but they are a big physical team. And if he can get a little more size in there, not that, you know, Henrik's a guy that's going to rock you around, but, again, able to absorb those blows, skate out of some trouble, I think he will avail himself of that possibility. But I don't think he'll make changes just for the sake of making changes. That's why I'm not sure if it's a hedge or a definite, but there certainly is a possibility. We'll see him.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Matt Lachlan. He's the Devils radio play-by-play man on WFAN Radio. Matt, previous segment before you came on, we were talking about Peter Harold a lot, and what jumped out at us was his time on ice for the first game. You know, over 21 minutes, 27 shifts altogether. When you look back at his previous games, especially last series against the Rangers and then the series before that and against Philly, he was closer to about 20 shifts and about 14 minutes. Why the jump in shifts and the time on ice? Has he really gained the confidence of Peter DeBoer to that extent?
He has, and I think that as Pete was looking for something to happen offensively, I mean, the Devils went 14 and a half minutes in the second period alone without a shot on goal. So Peter Harrell is not going to make anyone forget about Paul Coffey, and I don't say that to put Peter down. He's not really an offensive defenseman in the true sense, but he does have some offensive skills, and he's not afraid to put a shot on net. And so he's got experience. He's 28. Again, he's one of the guys that normally would be just that third-pair defense in this, but as things unfolded on Wednesday, Peter DeBoer needed more, and he needs it from the blue line. He keeps harping on that. We had Anton Volchenkov on as our post-game guest. Now, he was the goal scorer for the Devils, but it was off the deflected shot. But in talking about it, he said Pete told us we, meaning the defense, have to shoot. We have to get the puck on net more. And while Peter Harrell didn't have a ton of shots, I think he just had the one, if memory serves, the fact of the matter is he is not unwilling to get involved offensively. So I think that's why you saw him with more time on Wednesday.
So it's safe to say that a point of emphasis for the Devils coming into Game 2 is going to be activating the defense?
I think so. That's been a reason for their success in the second half of the season and in the playoffs. They're not a team that's going to jump out at you with their offensive numbers, but you look at what Bryce Salvador has been able to do here. He has 11 points in the playoffs. Martin Shidlitsky's gotten involved. You know, the Devils have indicated that they've got to get their D activated, as you said. They've got to have the correct pinch, keep the pucks alive as the teams try to wrap it around the board, be much more involved, make it more of a five-on-five game, not a three-forwards against five players game in your offensive zone. So don't think about dropping back solely. Listen, we don't want you to be playing carelessly, but we do need you involved more. So, yeah, that's it. Get that defense. I hope some good things follow from that.
One of the strengths of both teams, really, as you know, the playoffs have unfolded, is their ability to, as their depth and their ability to play four lines of forwards and to play six defensemen. You know, Peter DeBoer hasn't been terribly concerned about line matching and matchups throughout the playoffs. As we enter Game 2, do you expect that to continue, or do you think he'll maybe put a more of a point of emphasis on line matching as he still has the last change?
Yeah, I think he addressed it yesterday, and what he pointed out was it's not simply that he rolls the four lines, and I know you guys know that. He doesn't just roll the four lines willy-nilly. He just feels that the depth is an advantage that the Devils have. He's certainly aware of circumstances and will try to get matchups that favor him. But he feels, as Daryl Sutter does, because Daryl was asked the same question yesterday, that if you start seeking out matchups solely that work to your advantage, you constantly are calling guys off the ice because the other team made a move, then you're letting the opponent dictate your philosophy, and you wind up getting caught at times just in that whole game where you're chasing something that you can't ultimately get a hold of. So Pete does roll the four, but obviously the top guys see more time than anyone else. I think he'll continue the philosophy. He has a firm belief in the Devils' depth being one of the hallmarks of their success. And the one thing that he has shown throughout the year and in the playoffs is a rock-solid belief in his team. And I think if he changed his philosophy now, not to say he won't tweak it maybe here or there during a particular period, but overall I think you'll see him maintain the same philosophy, because if he changed now, it might send the wrong signal. I know you got to win, and I know you can't have a philosophy that you're stuck on if it leads to three more losses, because then you're gone. But I think he really has such a trust in that being a strength of the team that he's not going to vary it too much at this point.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Devils play-by-play man on WFAN Radio, Matt Lachlan.
Matt, Jakob Josefsson replaced Peter Sikora in the lineup last series after suffering an injury and missing parts of the regular season. And you saw him play all year. What did the Devils like about Josefsson so much that they wanted to put him in for Sikora, and now they're deciding to stay with Josefsson?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. First off, Peter Sikora was an integral part to team success, played in every game in the regular season, but he just seemed, starting last series, just to slow down a little bit. They need him to shoot. He still got the quick shot, but he just wasn't as sharp as he had been. You know, maybe not so noticeably that everyone stepped back and said, whoa, what's wrong with Peter, but just enough he was off his game. Josefsson was ready to come in. He's a very good two-way player. He's good on face-offs, and he's got a little more speed and a little bit more size. What he gives up in experience, he makes up for in those other areas. And it has balanced things out a little bit for the Devils. So I think we will see Jacob the rest of the way. But whether or not, again, Peter Sikora is a good weapon to have. And if things start to get tight, if you only score one goal tonight as you did the other night and you need some offense, you know, perhaps Peter will get another shot here. But I think at this point, Jacob Josefsson is here to stay.
Finishing off with this last one, Peter DeBoer won a Memorial Cup as head coach in Kitchener, but he really hasn't been this far as an NHL head coach. How much is he relying on Larry Robinson to help him with the additional nuances that come with playing in the Stanley Cup Finals?
A lot, and not just Larry, although he's got multiple Stanley Cup rings. But also, he has leaned on Lou Lamoriello. While Lou has not been on the ice in a Stanley Cup final, he's certainly been the man behind the scenes putting this organization on the map and putting the pieces together to lead them to three Stanley Cup championships and now a fifth visit in the final. This organization has a lot of Stanley Cup experience. Scott Stevens is a consultant. Jacques Lemaire is a consultant. So there are a lot of people you can turn to who have won cups, who have been in these positions, that Pete will ask for advice. And so one of the great strengths of Pete DeBoer is he's a listener. He has opened himself to his staff and to other people who have more experience than he does. You know, he will make the final decision, but he's not afraid to ask questions. And so he's got a vast library with the New Jersey Devils that he's called on.
Matt Lachlan, WFAN Radio. Enjoy the ride that you're on. I'm sure it's been an experience of a lifetime.
It's been terrific. It's been a joy. Knocking off your chief rival in the conference finals was magnificent. More work to do. Hopefully the Devils will come up with the four wins, but I can't complain. It's been a brilliant run till early June for sure.
Thanks very much, Matt. Have yourself enjoy game two. Have yourself a great call, and we'll probably be speaking with you maybe next week as well.
That would be great, fellas. Thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Matt. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Matt Lachlan, WFAN Radio in New York. He's the Devils radio play-by-play man. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our good friend Matt Lachlan for joining us live from New Jersey prior to Game 2 of the Devils Kings, which gets underway tonight at 7 o'clock. Check your local listings date and showtime. Is that what they say for movies sometime?
For the Stanley Cup?
No, I'm kidding. Obviously for the Stanley Cup they don't, but isn't that the tagline for movies?
Local listings. I just go on the app on my phone.
I think local listings is a euphemism more so than an actual thing nowadays. Do they still have local listings?
Do they still have TV guides? Does anybody still go buy a TV guide and still look at that?
I assume that Frank Costanza still has a subscription to TV guides.
Yeah, the magazine?
He was hoarding them.
Yeah, don't you remember? You had the collection of TV guides on Seinfeld?
I know the Seinfeld reference.
I'm just making sure you know the reference. I hope that you didn't lose too much blood when you chopped your finger and, you know, it's affecting your brain and everything at this point. That would be tragic. Still to come on the program in about 10 minutes' time, our good friend Rick Ralph is going to join us. A little bit later on, Bob Duff from the Windsor Star is going to join us. Gary Lawless, live from New Jersey in the final hour.
He's probably going to love that we're having Bob Duff of Windsor on. Good Peterborough boy, Gary Lawless.
but Windsor and Peterborough are nowhere near each other.
They're in Ontario.
So is Kenora and Peterborough.
Well, I'm saying, you know, Gary's from Ontario. Bob Duff is from Ontario.
Nice try, but it just didn't, this one didn't work.
That was
how,
not...
How far are Windsor and Peterborough apart?
I'm willing to bet that Windsor and Peterborough are...
An hour?
No, probably closer to 4 hours, maybe?
That's close.
I mean, I'm going to have to look at a map now. I mean, somebody, I'll have to Google driving time
it's
between...
Like, it's like Winnipeg and Brandon.
No.
Isn't that like 2 hours?
Hang on.
Google map it, Drew. Bring it up. Now, going on to the next topic.
Let's talk about 5 hours and 42 minutes to drive from Peterborough to Windsor. So I don't think they're brothers in arms or anything right now, Ezzy. Let's talk about Bob Harthey. He's been hired... Sort of an interesting scenario, because there was a report that, Ezzy, you passed along to us earlier in the week that said Bob Harthey was about to be hired as the head coach of the Montreal Canadiens.
Well, let me clarify that. Adrian Dater, who we've had on here before of the Denver Post, is obviously, you know, the foremost guy when it comes to the Colorado Avalanche. And, you know, it was a report, but he was tweeting it and writing articles about it as if it was going to happen. And we know that Bob Harthey was being interviewed by the Montreal Canadiens and, you know... By all reports, you know, they were prepared to hire him. And, you know, it came as a bit of a shock that the Calgary Flames had hired him. But based on Jay Feaster's past with him, with Hershey of the American Hockey League.
Yeah, you have to... Jay Feaster, who's the general manager of the Calgary Flames, and Bob Harthey go way back. They were together in Hershey, when Bob Harthey led the Hershey Bears to a...
Calder Cup.
To a Calder Cup, pardon me. Yeah, so they have a long time history together. So it makes perfect sense for why they would be a match there between general manager and head coach.
Right, and when we had Alan Mackey on a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about who we asked him who the Calgary Flames should go with, and he was mentioning that it should be a breath of fresh air and maybe a guy that you know is getting his first NHL coaching experience. And obviously, Bob Harthey has coached with the Thrashers and the Avalanche and has won a cup with the Avalanche. So in that sense, he is a veteran coach. But you know, Bob Harthey is going to bring a little something different than Brent Sutter. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, they always wanted a veteran coach because the Calgary Flames still haven't.
You hire Bob Harthey. Bob Harthey is a coach for a veteran team, and the Flames are certainly a veteran team, but they're no closer to being a legitimate contender than they have been the last number of years when they've lost out, when they've either not made the playoffs or they've lost out very quickly in the first round.
They haven't made
the
playoffs in 3 years.
This is still a team that does not, and we've spoken about this with our good friend George Johnson of the Calgary Herald a number of times, where you know we asked George, what's the plan for the Flames? And all you get on the other end of the line from George is a sigh, because nobody has any idea what the Flames are actually doing here. There's no rhyme or reason for any of the moves they make. They're not good enough to be a cup contender. They're not good enough really to be anything other than a fringe playoff team. And yet year in, year out, they go into the season with the same expectations and the same lineup.
I'll say that it looks like the Flames don't know if they're coming or going. But I think the thing with this signing is Jay Feaster, the previous coach, Brent Sutter, was not Jay Feaster's guy.
Right.
And when you're picking a coach and, you know, building that kind of management team, it's all about relationships. So Jay Feaster went with what he's comfortable with here, and I don't know if you can really fault him on that.
I don't fault him for that. I don't fault him for going with the guy that he's comfortable with. That's fine. I'm okay with that. What I fault the Flames for, and this is from president on down throughout the entire organization, is there is still no master plan in place.
You know what the master plan in place is for the Calgary Flames?
Mika Kiprusoff to recapture the 2004 Mika Kiprusoff?
Not just Mika Kiprusoff. They're trying to the Flames organization is trying to still relive the 2004 run, and it's not going to happen. And they are, Drew, going to go for the playoffs again this year. And the reason why they're going to go for it, because you've still got Jerome McGinley, who's still one of the top players in the league. You've still got Mika Kiprusoff. You've still got Jay Bouwmeester. You've brought Jokinen and Tange, who are going to be back. You've still got they're not going to have that many. The Flames aren't going to retool that much this year.
Then why is the team any better than they were last year?
I don't think they will be.
So, I mean, then isn't that a problem?
It is a problem.
Isn't it a problem as a Flames fan to finish, you know, 10th, 11th in the Western Conference year in and year out? And sure, you might be in the race right up until the last week of the season, but you're not really in it for any, you know, the Los Angeles Kings finished 8th, but everybody pinpointed the Kings as being a team way better than an eighth place team.
Let's clarify that for a second. The Kings are not an eighth place team. They were the biggest underachievers in the NHL this year, with the exception of maybe the Washington Capitals. The Kings could have easily been in the third seed where the Phoenix Coyotes were. So really, the Kings had trouble scoring goals all year. This was the best eighth place team ever. The seedings really mean nothing when you're in that situation where you're underachieving. Mike Richards didn't have a good regular season. Kopitar fell off. But no, Drew, you're right. It is a concern for the Flames and their fans. But when you're going to basically go for the playoffs again, and they're going to be in tough because you're going to be competing with the Dallas Stars. You're going to be competing with teams like the Edmonton Oilers for a playoff spot. They're going to be better next year. It's going to be tough for them to make the playoffs.
The Flames have really six key forwards under contract for next year. Olli Jokinen's a UFA. David Moss is a UFA. Lee Stempniak's a UFA. Tom Kostopoulos is a UFA. There's six key forwards that are under contract. Are Iginla, Camilleri, Roman Cervenka, who they brought over from the KHL on a one-year deal.
Didn't do a lot.
Well, no. This is his first year in the NHL. He was good in the KHL.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of Roman Horak.
Yeah, that's a different player altogether. Yeah. Alex Tanguy, overpaid. Matt Stajan, overpaid. And Curtis Glencross. They have six guys, really, under contract.
Right.
I don't know what they have $20 million in cap room, and so they need to add a lot of guys, and they don't have a ton of cap room to do it. I don't see how this team is any better than they were last year.
They're not really, and you look at a guy like Sven Berchi. He's going to make the team next year. When he came up, he was a good player.
Fine,
and they've they're going to expect more out of Michael Backlund, and he's turning out to
he's an RFA.
They'll re-sign him.
Yeah,
obviously.
Of course, as an RFA,
and he's been a guy who's now been given a couple years to show what he can do, and it's the jury's out. I don't know if he's going to be much more than maybe a third liner going forward.
If the Flames are coming back with the same roster, what they're hoping for is that Bob Hartley as the head coach is worth probably five wins.
Sure.
In order to put this team into the playoffs.
Right.
Now, I don't know that Bob Hartley is known as such a tremendous head coach or a tremendous tactician that he's worth an additional five wins, 10 points, however you want to cut it, through the course of a regular season.
Well, Drew, if you listen to what people say, people will compliment him and say that he's a motivator and say that he's a tactician and say that he is able to motivate his players and make them get the most out of his players. And he's won at every level. He just won a Swiss League title, and he's won at every level, including the QMJHL. But, that's basically a subjective situation where you can make the argument that, well, is he really better than Brent Sutter, who's also won at every level?
He spent 5 years as the head coach of the Thrashers, and granted, he might not have had a great team behind him, but one playoff appearance in 5 years? Is that success?
Well, there you go. That would be the counter argument. And
he was good in Colorado, but how much was he? How much of that was he tremendously responsible for?
Yeah, and he had Peter Forsberg and Ray Bourque and Joe Sakic.
And I can look good in Colorado as the head coach when I have Peter Forsberg, Ray Bourque, and Joe Sakic.
Well, I think you look good every day of the week.
Thank you. That's very nice of you.
But I like Bob Hartley's style, let's be honest. The teams when they made the playoffs, I believe that was 2007, and they got swept by the 2006 or 2007.
2007.
They got swept by the Rangers.
Four games
and
straight.
It was basically Ilya Kovalchuk and a bunch of other players.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. So, he didn't have very good teams there, and on a half glass empty situation, you could say, well, what did he do? He never won a playoff game. But then a half glass full, you could say, well, he was the only coach that ever got the Thrashers to the playoffs. But I think he will do a good job. But I still think right now that the Flames are in a situation where it's going to be very tough because they don't have a lot of secondary scoring, and you're counting on a lot of guys like Cervenka and Sven Berchi and Backlund, who, let's be honest, those aren't 1A prospects. You're expecting those guys to have better seasons. You're expecting an older Kiprusov again to play a lot of games. So as far as I'm concerned, the Flames aren't that much better on paper, but I think that Hartley is good in the sense that it's a veteran coach who's had success, and Sutter's act was getting tired in Calgary.
That's fine. I don't have a problem with the hire of Hartley. My problem goes back to what is the Flames' plan? And nobody, from anybody in this room to people who cover the Flames on a day-to-day basis, can sit down and say this is what their game plan is. Look, you look at the Jets, and people are pretty clear on what their game plan is. Build through the draft, gradually move their way up into becoming a upper echelon team through building through the draft and smart free agent signings and things of that nature.
I will say this though, Reem. I like a full season of Camilleri and Iggy together, because when they did play together in one season, they did work very well together. So I think that, those two guys are going to power the offense, but the only problem is, aside from those two guys, who else is getting the goals on that team?
Well, you're asking for a lot for those guys to recapture the magic to the same extent that they had, a number of years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you're hoping for lightning in the bottle twice, and could it happen? Sure. But I think you got a 34-year-old guy and you got a 30-year-old guy, and you're asking them to be as good as they were when they were, 5 years ago, and that doesn't happen all the time. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Rick Ralph. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Shortly past the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Michael Remus. Richard Pollock is away on vacation this week. Let's bring in our good friend. You know him well on this station. He is the host of the Jets pre- and post-game show, as well as the Stanley Cup Power Hour, heard weekdays from noon to 1. Rick Ralph, good afternoon. How are you, good sir?
Gentlemen, on a day like today, I am not unwell, I got to tell you. It is a lovely day out here in the city of Winnipeg.
It is. It makes you wonder why you haven't lived here your whole life, doesn't it?
But I find it sunny in other parts of the country at times, too. So, but anticipating a great summer, as long as the mosquitoes stay at bay.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do about that. That might be a little bit easier said than done. Rick, first of all, it's good to hear from you again. It's been a while since, of course, the season ended, and we haven't had our fill of maritime humor. So that's why
I've been avoiding you guys, really.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I mean, I certainly don't blame you. And, the restraining order, I thought, was a little bit over the top, but whatever.
Well,
that's
you
okay.
You got to do what you got to do at times, right?
Yeah, I don't argue. No argument. I've trying to file a restraining order against Ezra on a weekly basis, and they keep rejecting it.
Well, Rick,
yeah.
I knew there was something up during the season when you moved away from the Illegal Curve. There was five of us, and I know that you found there was a little bit too much of us there, so you moved. I knew there was something up there.
I didn't want to be associated with the group that keeps taking all the M&Ms and Smarties in the media box, so yeah, I didn't want to get looped into that, because that'll catch up to you.
Yeah, eventually, they're going to present us a bill here sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Needless to say, we're going bankrupt very quickly. Rick, game one between the Kings and the Devils happened a couple nights ago. Game two tonight. You expect a much more, not competitive, but just sort of the feeling out process being finished with, and both teams are ready to get after it and really get for the cup now?
Well, I think the Kings were a little more prepared. Maybe not more prepared. I think both teams are prepared to the hilt at this point. But the Kings were able to execute what they wanted to accomplish in game one more so than the Devils. And what you attribute that to, not sure. You'd think with the Kings with a bigger layoff, maybe it came out a little bit rusty, but they didn't. And the Devils, maybe coming off such a grueling series before, more so than the LA Kings, just didn't have the level that they needed to get to. Because I heard Wayne Gretzky talking the other day on one of our affiliates, and he mentioned that, there's four parts to the season. There's the exhibition season. There's the regular season. There's the first three rounds of the playoffs. And each of these levels requires you to jump up a notch, and then the Stanley Cup final requires you to jump even to another notch, and I don't think the Devils made that leap just yet. They were outplayed by the Kings in game one, and like you guys mentioned, I would think that you'll see a much more even contest here coming up in game two today.
Rick, Andrei Kopitar obviously got the overtime game winner, and he seems to be right now a front runner for the Conn Smythe along with Dustin Brown and Jonathan Quick. It's going to be tough, but if he keeps getting these game-winning goals, it's going to be tough not to give it to him. On the New Jersey Devils, who do you think is going to have to elevate their game in game two? Because really, nobody stood out, and the only goal that the Devils got was off of Slava Voynov's face, courtesy of Anton Volchenkov. So who's the key guy on New Jersey, or is there a couple of guys that really need to step up so that they don't go back to L.A. down 2-0?
Well, you mentioned the trio of guys there with L.A. If you go to New Jersey, you need Marty Brodeur, Mr. Kovalchuk, and Iliash to be, I think, your three guys that lead the way. But it's not just going to be a couple of guys. You need everybody to step up. And you get into the playoffs and get into the Stanley Cup final, it's always the guys that you don't expect to hear from that seem how to come through with contributions. And that requires all four lines. And looking at the ice time of both of those teams in game one, I think the lowest ice time that any one of the guys got was roughly 9.5 to 10 minutes, which is really astounding when you think about it, that both teams are running four lines. So while you need a couple of guys to lead the charge, for New Jersey, I do think the three I mentioned are the guys that you need to step up, but everybody's got to go with them.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by our good friend, Rick Ralph. Now, Rick, for anybody that listens to the Stanley Cup Power Hour, which I assume is everybody, they know that you sort of have a historical dislike of the New Jersey Devils. Has that lessened at all as this playoff run has carried on?
Yeah, it's not so much the Devils as it's just New Jersey. I'm not fond of the Newark Airport or the Newark area, although Hoboken is a very nice area of New Jersey. But it goes back to Wayne Gretzky, taking that shot at the Devils back in 1983 about a Mickey Mouse organization.
And you've said the same about us, though.
But at least Gretzky and the Devils have changed, right? I mean, Gretzky, admits and still does and apologizes profusely about that. And the fallout, that was different. But there's been a lot of change in New Jersey. They had the trap system that was there years ago, go back 10 years, and they would play that neutral zone trap, and it was defensive-first hockey. And Jacques Lemaire was a big part of that. But Lou Lamoriello, Lemaire started to change that. Lamoriello, who's been there forever, basically since the fur trade, has done a great job of evolving with a hockey club, not just building it the same way year after year. He's actually changed the approach. And now you've got guys like Kovalchuk who have come in to provide a little more offense to a hockey club that was always known as the stagnant defensive-first hockey team. So they've actually been much more entertaining to watch. And what can you say about Marty Brodeur? I mean, the guy's been an absolute all-star, each and every year. And I wrote him off at the start of this year. I thought he was done. And here he is in the Cup Final proving most of us wrong, especially me.
Rick, we wanted to transition a little bit to the NHL draft. It's still about 3.5 weeks away, and I'm first off going to assume that you watched the entire coverage of the draft combine and took notes for us for the purposes of this interview. But,
yeah.
The Jets have the 9th overall pick, and there's been a lot of coverage on the station and in the Winnipeg Free Press, obviously, and other outlets about whether, Kevin Cheveldayoff is going to make a move. Do you think that, there's a chance that he makes a move and tries to maybe trade up or takes the opportunity at the draft to maybe move some players? Or do you think it's too early to make that assumption or give a definitive answer based on the fact that, there's a lot that can happen between now and then?
Well, I think that's just it, what you said there at the end. There's a lot that could happen between now and then. A lot of GMs are going to be talking back and forth before they get to the draft. The actual draft is nothing but conversations between GMs. There's agents also working different angles of some of their clients, ones that have not necessarily been drafted, but ones that are looking for a trade out of their market. So it'll be interesting to see. I think general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff is going into this with an open plan. And having said that, I mean, they've gone through multiple different mock drafts, all kinds of options as to what could possibly happen, both in and out of their control, as to what players will be available for them to draft at number 9. At the same time, there's going to be GMs that are going to be offering them whatever to move up in the draft or possibly moved out of the draft complete with that 9 pick for a player that, is ready to step into your lineup in the next year or two. So I think he's going to evaluate all of that as you go forward, and I don't think he's going in with the idea that we have to draft somebody and this is going to be the person, or we have to trade the pick to get up to a certain draft to get somebody. I don't think he's got a very specific plan in that regard, other than to listen to all offers and make the best move going forward. Because I don't think this hockey club, some people are going to hope, why don't you trade the pick away for somebody that can bring in and help you right now. But I don't know that the hockey club heading into this year, hoping there is a hockey season, is ready to take, they're going to take a step forward, but I don't know if it's going to be a big leap. And what they're trying to do is build this organization with some depth. And if you've got people from other organizations coming in to take your number 9 pick or one of your younger players, what you're going to give up to get back in return is just going to delay your growth. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him take the number 9 pick and select a player and continue to grow. Or if they feel that core nucleus with Bufflin and Ladd and Bogosian coming in, if that's your core nucleus and you're aiming at maybe 3-4 years down the road, they'll never publicly say that. But if that's their plan, then maybe you pick up somebody that, is a little further ahead than an 18-year-old would be. But I have a feeling that there's no rush. They want to get better as they go here, obviously, but there's no rush to jump ahead and do it. They want to do this the right way and build from within, and that's going to take a little while.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Rick Ralph of, TSN 1290, of course. Rick, you mentioned the draft, and, I was having this discussion last night as I was enjoying a beverage or two, and I was debating with another guy about, should the team look at what they, when you're drafting 9th overall, sort of in the top, third of the first round,
Do you subscribe to the theory that the team should take the best available player, or do you subscribe to the theory that the team should look at where their biggest weakness is and take that player, even if that player might be further down on the draft board, as it were?
I don't think you take a player based on your weakness now, because somebody that you're drafting is possibly not going to work into your lineup for another 4 to 5 years, especially when it comes to a defenseman. Forwards, I mean, with some teams, you've seen 18, 19, 20-year-olds get in, but there's not that many that do it every year. There might be one or two. So if you're selecting ninth overall, I think you're looking at the best possible player to get. And then you've got an 18-year-old. Going forward, if that person works into your mix, great. If they don't, they become an asset that you can trade away for something else that you would rather get at that point. I think that's the route you go. You take the best player available at that time. You don't try and fill holes with pieces that aren't going to fix those holes for a number of years, because as you know, going forward, anything could change. What's a hole in this coming year may not be a hole 2-3 years from now, and it may get changed by a trade or a free agent signing. That's something you don't predict 1 or 2 years from now.
Rick, on Thursday it came out that Tim Thomas, it was confirmed, and we should say this isn't, you know, necessarily going to happen, but it was confirmed that Tim Thomas is thinking about sitting out next season. Now, did this come as a surprise to you? And have you ever heard of a guy at this stage in his career, especially, you know, basically just over a year, well, no, exactly a year off of a Stanley Cup win, taking a season off for a reason not related to an injury?
Now, it's a little bit strange from what I can remember back years. I don't recall, especially a player at this age, what is he, 38 now?
Yeah.
To me, to take a year off, I mean, you can make the argument with Dominic Hasek, but to take a year off, to then come back and try and pick up where you left off, especially at that age, becomes much more difficult. And I'm not saying it's impossible, but I really do think it's strange that at this point in his career he would do that and then want to come back and be able to perform at the level. I don't know that the Bruins would be interested in him taking a year off and then coming back the following year.
Especially based on the comments from Peter Chiarelli yesterday during his press conference, it really did sound like they finally have reached the last straw with Tim Thomas and his, how do I say this politely, eccentricities?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, along the line, I mean, Peter Chiarelli has to put a winning hockey club on the ice. I mean, they're going forward. They don't have time to take a year off.
Right.
So if he's going to do that, I understand the club wanting to go in another direction. They may already want to go in that direction now. So, you know, the legacy that is Tim Thomas, unfortunately, as great a goaltender as he is probably going to be remembered. If this does happen and takes the year off, he'll be remembered for the White House and the shenanigans in the final couple of years of his career, unfortunately.
Yep. Rick, we'll let it go right there. We appreciate you giving of your time, and we'll let you get back to what I'm sure is a very exciting Saturday afternoon.
Well, first thing on the docket is to change my number so you guys can find me.
Amazing. Perfect, Rick. Thanks very much. Have yourself a good one.
All right, boys. Thanks.
Take care, Rick. Rick Ralph, you know him as the Jets pre- and post-game show host and the host of the Stanley Cup Power Hour here on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to our guests thus far, Rick Ralph and Matt Lachlan. In case you missed those interviews or any of the program as a whole, you can download the show on iTunes, search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time from the Windsor Star, Bob Duff is going to join us. Bob obviously covers the Detroit Red Wings for the Windsor Star, so he really does know a lot about Nicklas Lidström, and we'll be spending a lot of time with Bob talking about Lidström, who announced his retirement earlier this week. We wanted to get our two cents in, as it is our prerogative, as we are the, you know, hosts and stars of the show. Well, I'm the star. You're more the supporting cast over there.
Right, you're the star. We're just riding your coattails.
Exactly, right. That's exactly. In fact, I couldn't have said it better myself. We'll have to use that audio for future reference and, you know, promos and whatnot. Anyways, Nicklas Lidström, is there any doubt in your mind that, you know, 1-2 in terms of the all-time best defenseman is Nicklas Lidström and Bobby Orr?
That's a tough one. I was thinking about that.
And we know you're Devils biased.
Well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, as far as... I do believe that Bobby Orr is the greatest defenseman of all time. When we were talking about Marty Brodeur being the best goalie of all time last week, I think I mentioned that, in my opinion, Orr and Gretzky as far as those positions, forward and defense. But, you know, the question of how good Nicklas Lidström is a really good one, because in my opinion, he is a top five defenseman. I think it's tough to, I mean, a lot of people were saying that, you know, he's the second best defenseman. I even read and heard some people say that he was even better than Bobby Orr. But I don't agree with that. But, you know, Nicklas Lidström retired this year, and recently, after this past season. And, you know, this past season, he actually was a lot better than he was last year when he had the injury problems and all that. And, you know, Nicklas Lidström probably could have played a couple more years, and it sounds like he was considering it. And Ken Holland was maybe not shocked, but he was a little bit surprised. Probably he would have liked, when you have a guy like Nicklas Lidström, you'd like him to probably play until he was 45 or 46. But, you know, the question of...
He's 42.
Of, right.
I mean, how much more do you want from that guy?
Right. But the question of, you know, where he ranks, I mean, this is always subjective. But I think you got to look at it in terms of his era. So maybe from the early to mid-90s until now. And, you know, I think that you can make the strong argument that he was the best of his era. So, and you have to include even the Ray Borks and the Paul Coffeys, but more recently, you got to throw in, you know, the class of Chris Pronger and Scott Niedermeyer and those guys. And to me, another thing, you know, that makes Nick Lidström so special is not only did he only play with one team like Marty Brodeur, but the fact that he was always, always consistent and always played a lot and always played against the top guys. And in this day and age, when you have a guy that's a good offensive defenseman but not a good defensive defenseman, well, Lidström was the best at both. And, you know, that's why he won 7 Norris, and he was nominated for, I think, 10 or 11 of them. And the thing that really stands out for me, Reem, with Nicklas Lidström is he almost never made a mistake, and he made playing defense look easy. And you can make an argument that defense is one of the hardest positions. You see guys come and go more than any other position on defense. But to me, Nicklas Lidström was always in the right position and made playing defense look easy. And that's tough to do when you're that good at it.
He's also very good, but I think part of it making it look easy is, you know, when his retirement press conference, he listed off, you know, all the players he played on. Yep. And it made me
unselfish.
But it made me think about those great teams that he had. You know, when you have Yzerman, Fedorov, Shanahan, Cicerelli, Hull, Robitaille, how many Hall of Famers did he play with? It's pretty remarkable.
He had a good supporting cast, no doubt about that. But I think the Red Wings' success, and I mean, the success has almost been unprecedented. Year in, year out, they're always up at the top there. I mean, this year, yep, they went out early in the first round, but, yeah, you know, year in, year out, they're there. I think it started and ended with Nicklas Lidström.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, he never had dominating goaltending behind him, and they didn't need dominating goaltending because he was so good in his own zone, and he was so good as a defenseman that it made all their probably average goaltenders look that much better.
Drew, now that Brian Rafalski is retired and Nicklas Lidström is retired, all of a sudden that Red Wings defense is not looking too good.
Well,
and that's why we're
going to talk to Bob Duff about, yep, that. That's, you know, the name that jumps to mind, of course, is Ryan Suter.
They're not panicking. They don't panic in Detroit. But I'm throwing in Zetterberg and I'm throwing in Datsyuk. The one guy that they've been dreading this day is Nicklas Lidström. And you're absolutely right. Nicklas Lidström has been there. He's been manning the power play year after year after year, and he's been there in every single playoff run. Wow. And he's always given them nothing but the best. And, you know, with Nicklas Lidström out now, you've got a guy that, you know, he would always play top minutes. He would always go against the other team's top line, and now you're scrambling. And, you know, for the Detroit Red Wings, who didn't have the best year this year, now you've got no Nicklas Lidström, you've got no Brian Rafalski. I think right now,
barring some moves,
yep,
barring some significant upgrades to the defense,
yep,
more so than the forwards, but the defense, barring some significant expenditure, they might not be a playoff team.
That's how good he is. I don't think that's an overstatement. I think Nicklas Lidström is that good that, yeah, you take Nicklas Lidström off your team. Look what happened with Philadelphia. You know, Chris Pronger went down. It took a while for them to adapt. It so happens that they're blessed with, you know, some of the best forwards in the league. But, yeah, you take Nicklas Lidström out of there, and there's problems. I mean, Brad Stewart has injury problems.
He's a free agent anyways.
There you go. I mean, yeah. But he wasn't that good this year and didn't play at certain times this year. But, you know, Nicklas Lidström is that good that you lose him. And yes, you really have to basically, and Drew, this is the thing as well. You've built your entire team around him being your number one defenseman. So you don't ever have to worry. You could throw essentially anybody out there with Nicklas Lidström and it's not going to hurt you. And now you have a problem where now all of a sudden the guy you've built your defense around for 20 years is gone.
Now, it's certainly a problem that doesn't come as a shock to them. He's not retiring, you know, at 32 and when he's still under significant contract. And he's not retiring because of injury. And they're not in trouble like, say, Philadelphia is with Pronger as a result of the cap ramifications there, potentially.
Because he was under a one-year contract.
Well, exactly. He was on these, handshake agreements more than anything else. And, I mean, if 3 months down the road from now he changed his mind and wanted to come back, they'd welcome him back with open arms.
Absolutely.
But they say there's a theory you're always better off to go out 1 year too soon before 1 year too late. And this is the first year, if you read some of the experts, so to speak, they said this is the first time they've noticed Lidström having to make concessions for his loss of foot speed. He would play a little bit further off of the incoming forward so that to not be beaten to the outside because he didn't have the same wheels that he had even just a couple of years ago, which is to be expected. He's 42 years old, so it's not like that's a comment, but, rather than it be him becoming a liability, not that he necessarily was going to become a liability, but rather than that conversation from even beginning, he went out at this point in time on top of the world as a defenseman, still pretty close to up there, and on his own terms, with his own health, and he goes out as a king, really, in Detroit and amongst this generation's defensemen.
It's always tough, to know when to step away. You see guys maybe like Chris Chelios, who's hanging on to play in the AHL, or Emmett Smith, who was, moved around to Arizona.
Well, you often see, you're right, you're exactly right. In all sports, you often see guys that go play one more year somewhere else from where they had their greatest success, and it never works. I mean, Emmett Smith went and played that other year in Arizona. Exactly right. Joe Namath went and played a year. I think it was for the L.A. Rams back then. I'm not 100% sure. But there is always these cases of people, and I don't fault them because it's hard to step back from when it's all you've known your entire life. A lot of these athletes, from the day they were 16, 17, 18 years old, what are you? Your identity is wrapped up in playing the sport you play. What are you? You're a hockey player. You're a football player. You're a basketball player, whatever it may be. And it's hard to separate yourself from that sport when you don't play that sport anymore.
Well, when I think about guys who've gone on top, obviously Gretzky is the first one that comes to mind. And even, in terms of TV shows, Seinfeld, just knowing when to walk away. Because you don't want to see, as much as you like to still see him play, but it's kind of, gets upsetting when you see them not playing at the level that they're used to seeing
sure.
them play
when
at.
You see, exactly. You're used to, you've set this standard, and a high standard, and when they don't quite reach it, or you notice, slippage in skill, it is something that, is hard to accept as a fan. It's hard to accept as a player or a performer. And it's, you don't even want those conversations really to come to light before, before you hang it up.
And Reem, further to that point, I think Nick Lidström knows that the Detroit Red Wings don't want him to be 75% of Nick Lidström, because then he is hurting them. So I think he's very aware that he's not going to be contributing at that level, and no one needs to tell him that. Even though they would gladly take a 75% Nick Lidström, he doesn't want to give them that.
75% of Nick Lidström is still a pretty good NHL defenseman.
He's probably better than 90% of the defensemen.
But Nick Lidström himself won't accept 75%.
Well, they asked him at the press conference, is this a case of, the tank being empty? He's like, no, it's not empty, but it's just not full.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's really where, and that's when you want to cut it before it hits empty, and then they have to sort of push you out the door. It's always better to go out on your own terms.
But Drew, really, just really quickly, to wrap up the, whether he's the second best defenseman of all time or whatever, I think when you have this many people reacting to his retirement and just using the words great and one of the best
so
of all
many
time.
Of his own, of his peers,
he's
of
up
players.
There. Whether you want to say second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever,
right.
He's one of the best of all time easily.
Oh, every NHLer, 95% of the NHLers who are on Twitter sent out tweets of congratulations to Nicklas Lidström because they knew how much excellence they were losing. And last night in Detroit at the Red Hot Chili Peppers concert, the Chili Peppers brought out Nicklas Lidström on stage to a standing ovation.
It's amazing.
Let's go to break. When we come back, Bob Duff of the Windsor Star is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.